for the sound of hoofbeats on the ice.
The eastern world, it is exploding. Violence flaring, bullets loading. You're old enough to kill, but not for voting. You don't believe in war, but what's that gun you're toting? And even the Jordan River has bodies floating. But you tell me over and over and over again, my friend, you don't believe we're on the eve of destruction. Don't you understand what I'm trying to say? Can't you feel the fears I'm feeling today? If the button's pushed, there's no running away. There'll be no one to save with the world in a grave. Take a look around you, boy. It's bound to scare you, boy. And you tell me over and over and over again, my friend. You don't believe we're on the eve of destruction. Yeah, my blood's so mad, feels like coagulating. I'm sitting here just contemplating. I can't twist the truth, it knows no regulation. Handful of senators don't pass legislation, and marches alone can't bring integration. When human respect is disintegrating, this whole crazy world is just too frustrating. And you tell me over and over and over again, my friend, you don't believe we're on the eve of destruction. Think of all the hate there is in Red China, then take a look to Selma, Alabama. You may leave here for 4 days in space, but when you return, it's the same old place. The pounding of the drums, the pride and disgrace. You bury your dead, but don't leave a trace. Hate your next door neighbor, but don't forget to say grace. And tell me over and over and over again, my friend, you don't believe we're on the eve of destruction. No, 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 you don't believe we're on the eve of destruction. Barry McGuire recorded the most famous performance of that song in just one take, right after he got it from musician P.F. Sloan, who was playing behind him. It got leaked to a DJ and was an instant hit, getting all the way to number one on September 25th, 1965. People often update the lyrics when they sing that to make it reflect more current events. But I thought I'd go with the original words because the issues really haven't changed all that much, even though it's been 50 years. That's why we bring you this show, the New American Dream Radio Show, streaming live every Thursday from 6 to 8 p.m. on Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com. We're glad that you're listening. We invite you to tune in every week. And don't forget that listener-supported Revolution Radio deserves your support. They have a phenomenal lineup, and like I said, they're completely listener-supported. I'm Chuck Gregory, and I'm proud now to introduce my friend and co-host, Mike Palachuk, an American writer.
Hello, Chuck. Tonight we welcome back special guests Phil Ferruccio, Anthony Reason, Larry Pinkney, and M.K. Davis. And so tonight we are gathering for the New American Dream Radio Show in Fort Lauderdale, Duluth, Port Orange, Chicago, Minneapolis, Benton, Mississippi, and wherever you are. A note, please, about Dr. Kevin Barrett versus Maxine Dover on Press TV, talking about the killing of the three young Muslims in Chapel Hill and also about 9/11. You can see her and watch and listen to that on Press TV. been on NBC Media Broadcasting Company to watch Jim Fetzer and Jay Whitener talking about the fake moon landings. And we are presenting a truth book series, Save the World, Resist the American Empire. The first book, the dynamic duo biography of Jim Fetzer and Kevin Baird, is completed and available and in process is a book showing that nobody died at Sandy Hook or Boston. Next will come a book that will explore the questions of whether we went to the moon and whether the Holocaust happened as we are being told. Also, whether Paul McCartney died a long time ago. The fourth book will show that nuclear weapons were used by Israel and persons within the United States government on the World Trade Center towers, and that the U.S. media is guilty of being an integral part of a domestic operation Gladio and cataloging and explaining the rash of U.S. false flag, false terror events in recent years. The entire series entitled Save the World, Resist the American Empire is scheduled for release in 2015. And back now for a moment to the first book in our series, which is now available, that dynamic duo, White Rose Blooms in Wisconsin, Kevin Baird, Jim Fetzer, and the American Resistance. A whole new form of government is going to take over the country, Jack Ruby said. That's what it was, wasn't it? We hoped and waited for something like what we had been born with, and as if it was always there, but it was gone. We started out spoiled, all this stuff going on, running full blast, riding a bike down the street with no hands, arms outstretched. We didn't even see the wall. Could you believe the Warren Commission? I mean, believe that it really happened, and we did not have riots because of it. But rather, we just say, oh, well, and so. Bush fought the 9/11 Commission. He did not want to testify alone. Was the commission meeting in the dark with spiders? After 9/11, all the propaganda to promote the war, terror alerts, where did those go? Osama bin Laden tapes in the middle of the afternoon on Fox and CNN and NBC, 9/11 Commission, finally. And then what a supreme joke that was, and we settled for it. Building 7, controlled demolition, where's the plane in the Pentagon? Shanksville, dancing Israelis. And still, the Bushes ride in a golf cart down the third baseline, waving to the crowd, and are greeted by cheers rather than tomatoes, fists, and handcuffs. Karl Rove, Rumsfeld, Cheney, walk free. Condoleezza Rice teaches at Stanford rather than being locked up forever in one of those high-tech concentration camps we have, like in Florence, Colorado, and shuffling off to the shower each morning wearing ankle shackles and a waist chain and fluorescent orange pajamas for the rest of their lives. If we're going to have these insane places, we might as well put the worst of the worst there. And that would be George and George Bush, Dick Cheney, Karl Rove, Rice, Rumsfeld, and whatever other dozens have conspired, continued to conspire to overthrow this country, who know the truth and don't tell the rest of us, FBI Director Mueller, General Tommy Franks, and all the other generals who acted as commentators on NPR and Fox, ensuring us that the coming war was so cool, so good, so right. And now we have how many hundreds of thousands of dead human beings in Iraq and Afghanistan, just people living their lives, found themselves in the way of the American quest for gold, for dominance, and the thousands of young Americans who have died and had their lives ruined because of a lie, a huge, amazing lie perpetrated by men and women we asked in good faith to lead us on our way. Bush, Obama, Card, Clinton, Fleischer, Wolfowitz, Ashcroft, Pearl, O'Reilly, all those names who, if history ever writes itself, will be synonymous with Goebbels, Goering, Himmler. Our history stems from that day, from that place, from November 22nd, 1963, about 12:30 p.m., Dallas, Texas, Memphis, Los Angeles, Oklahoma City, New York City, Washington, D.C., Eveleth, Minnesota, Aurora, Sandy Hook, Boston, Fallujah, Kabul, Kandahar, and whatever is happening right now, what is coming, unless we stop it, us, you, we, me. Who was really behind the anthrax attacks? Isn't it important, at least as important as Paul Revere's ride or a crack bell? Have you ever Googled JFK assassination at 11:30 at night and then found yourself still on the computer in their living room when the family is getting up for school and work? I used to wish upon a star, daydream that when I die, I would ask the very first thing after I set down my suitcases, who killed JFK? But now, thanks to the tears and sweat and blood of Jim Fetzer, Kevin Baird, and many others, I can save that wish, keeping that one big question for something else, because I already know that one. Fetzer and Baird do not face being beheaded by a guillotine in the basement of the county building on the corner of Main and First, not that we know of. If someone finds out about their writing or hears their radio shows or sees them speak at a public meeting, that is not the American means of beheading. An American cuts off your head at your neck by taking away the ball. It's his anyway, not allowing you to play, by rolling his eyes at you as you pass on the street, as he passes a stuffing across the Thanksgiving table, or interviews you on national television. You may live here, die here. You will be free to do what you want, say what you want, but we will speak no more about you. That is how it has gone all these years in America, at least since November 23rd, 1963. But still, there are those who care enough to try a one full court hook shot with time running out, and they are heroes whether that shot goes in or not. The White Rose students wrote leaflets, words, and distributed them and were considered worthy of decapitation by the government. Fetzer and Barrett write and speak, making their education, experience, ideas, and opinions available to as many people as they can. And no doubt they are also known and reviled by those in power. They are a face of the resistance in America, which does exist in many forms. The resistance in America has a long and storied history. All the way from Amon Hennessy, Dorothy Day, Peter Moore, and Emma Goldman, so many names unknown to American school children and now American adults. Does anyone know the names Kevin McGuire, Gene Peterson, Dale Rupiper, Larry Rosebaugh, Roy Bourgeois, Megan Rice? No, all are members of the American White Rose, resistors to the empire, unknown to their countrymen, yet very real. Fetzer and Barrett are two American heroes. You can read about them in a book by CWG Press, The Dynamic Duo, available at createspace.com. The whole series is coming to you in 2015. Back to you, Chuck.
Now, stay tuned for the American Dream Something Something Playhouse Theater, sponsored by General Electric. Tonight, we hear the voice of a legendary American journalist who covered the civil rights movement up close and now reports on the Bush and Obama misdeeds. That writer, journalist, real newspaper man is Sherwood Ross. Ross is an actual reporter who did not lie to us. The United States is slipping into dictatorship as it is spending gigantic amounts of money for wars instead of internal issues. The country is being run by the military-industrial complex. This country is slipping into dictatorship. The people of the world have got to be made aware that it is dangerous. It is armed and dangerous. U.S. authorities are spending $700 billion for war. They are spending, by contrast, $500 million for the Peace Corps. Those figures have got to be turned around. Why don't we hear about shootings in Glencoe, Winnetka, and Wilmette, Illinois, and in the well-to-do suburbs? It's because there's no poverty in those suburbs. It's because people aren't struggling with other people for the basic necessities of life. Aristotle's quotation saying poverty is the parent of crime and revolution is true. We do not have a president, and we have not had presidents who will address the problems of inner cities, Ross said. Unless we have a president who will do something for people of color in our country, who will improve the schools, who will improve the job or opportunities, who will improve the housing, who will give people a reason to live with dignity and respect. We are not going to have an end to the gun culture, even if we were to pass 100 laws banning guns. It would not end. We need a more fundamental change than that. This has been the New American Dream Something Something Playhouse Theater, sponsored by General Electric. Tonight, we heard the voice of a legendary American journalist, Sherwood Ross. Ross was and is an actual reporter who did not lie to us. Oh, what a perfect day, a perfect town, in a perfect house, on the perfect side of the street. And now another episode of Sitting on the Floor at Ward Cleaver's Feet, listening to Ward Cleaver. Ward Cleaver speaks. Remember the peace dividend? They didn't want peace. Remember the first fake World Trade Center bombing? That was our baptism to fear Muslims. The Patriot Act, anthrax, Wellstone, the Department of Homeland Security, modeled on the East German Stasi. A lot of thought has gone into all of this, Beaver. Manifest Destiny, the American Century, American exceptionalism, globalization, or as Madeleine Albright put it, the indispensable nation, while others less kind have used the term imperialist. My, oh my, such webs of deception these spiders weave. If Sandy Hook can be ripped open for total exposure to the germicidal light of sunshine, this can only tear asunder numbers of other episodes of total lawless corruption. Once started, this tornado won't stop until it lands at the foot of the real guilty parties. Beeve, let me tell you, there's nothing like the smell of wood smoke with noosed corpses dancing in the dappled light of morning. Oh, what a perfect day in a perfect town, in a perfect house, on the perfect side of the street, sitting on the floor at Ward Cleaver's feet, listening to Ward Cleaver.
And reveal. Now, when I say in camera, I mean the one that was actually in the camera, not a generated copy. So I know from my experience that most claims about having examined the original film are unfounded and not true. The original film has never been made available to study. Now, when the copies that are closest to the original in-camera film are taken apart and enhanced frame by frame, and lens defects corrected, and then reassembled and stabilized, a very different conclusion about the film is hard not to come to. And that is that the subject in the film is legitimately alive and wearing nothing in the way of clothing or gear. Patterson's film by itself is good enough to stand alone as evidence of the existence of Bigfoot. Now, unless you're just determined in your own mind not to believe anything. The digital age has brought about a plethora of new images and video of Bigfoot, and this has resulted in a cottage industry of analysts to whom many people rely on for their opinions. They even have apps on phones now that will insert Bigfoot into your scene, whatever you videotaped. So, you know, it's these people have kind of stepped in and said, well, we can, sort all this out for you. So you see this cottage industry of clever breakdown experts, and people use them quite a bit because nobody wants to be suckered. Now, I have found a number of video, film, and audio files that, separate and apart from the Patterson film, I believe, are not just conceptual, but form a body of evidence that the big fellow is indeed out there. It's what keeps a fellow like me going, that long shot, and that one in a million chance that we don't know all there is to know. Now, Bigfoot haunts the psyche of nearly all the great cultures. It is an all-pervading idea or concept that covers the globe and explaining the dawn of man and what preceded man. We think that we know most everything there is to know. I personally have found that in my efforts to uncover solid evidence about the existence of Bigfoot, that this current culture that I find myself in has not nearly unraveled the great mystery of the peopling of the Americas, or for that matter, the peopling of the world. It's a project that is so immense that if it were to be all written down in volumes, you could not study the volumes in your lifetime. Bigfoot is about you. Bigfoot is about me. Bigfoot is about our place in the universe and how we came to be where we are. Bigfoot is about a wayward kinship that we have learned to sweep beneath the rug and put out of our collective minds. So we seek ways to make such a thing or such an idea unnecessary. Now, I have a parrot, and it's an African gray. One of those birds you see, there's a famous bird called Einstein. It knows all these different words and everything. He's that breed of bird. But he's extremely afraid of a broom. And when I read some on the bird, I found that when such birds used to be trapped in nets and exported to the United States, they were scared toward the nets by people waving brooms. Well, he never experienced that, but he has that fear. And through the process of acquired genetics, the distant memory of that trauma has remained in the birds down through the generations. Perhaps Bigfoot, too, is a distant memory that resonates among the many cultural divides that separate man today. Each generation springs forward and upward, and we improve ourselves with each generation. But at the same time, we have a latent memory of perhaps what we once were that we dare not let go. Like the parrot's memory of the broom. Why should you believe in Bigfoot? Well, there's sufficient space for him to live. There's sufficient food for him to eat. There's sufficient evidence that he is there. And he will be there if there is sufficient courage threat to believe in a legend. That it?
No,
is that it?
Keep on going.
Okay. So here I find myself turning over rocks and looking behind trees and old buildings and writing down old stories and picking my way across this country, running down leads. Most turn out as nothing, but sometimes, some places, and with some people, the trail heats up. It's one of those bizarre situations where you are reaching out, indeed reaching forward, for the past. I then realize that it's not singularly Bigfoot that I believe in, but it is myself that I'm reaching out for all those problems that science has trouble explaining. We as human beings are gifted with abstract thought. Mankind loves a simple solution, and science grapples for such in these matters, but I suspect that the answers lie in the abstract areas and that of the unexpected. Indeed, it is the abstract that has propelled us beyond our physical limits and has released the power of the theory and the power of open-mindedness, and indeed the power of acceptance that we cannot know the mind of God, but rather we can only learn of it because it is dynamic and flows like water. I deal in images, less so in words. Seeing is believing. The eyes of our cameras are our cameras and the brain our hard drive, and the eyes actually see upside down. The software in our brain writes the image for us. Half of seeing is processing. Might we see also by processing information other than the eyes? Bode's law described the number and position of all the planets as well as the asteroid belt before telescopes were powerful enough to see these bodies. 0 is the sun, 3 is Mercury, 6 is Venus, 12 is the Earth, 24, you just keep doubling the numbers, and when you add 4 to them and divide them by 10, you get the distance to each planet in astronomical units. This man did this with his head. He couldn't see anything. He did it all in his mind, and it is accurate, except for one number, which is 2.8 astronomical units. And then it ended up being the asteroid belt. There's no planet there, but there was a destroyed planet. So my point is that the search for Bigfoot is not an undoable thing. Somehow in the pursuit, the skills developed, the doors of the mind that are open, the experiences that are so profound will make you more than you are. In that sense, Bigfoot has always existed among the movers and shakers of mankind, on whose shoulders we all now stand. You can learn a little bit more about me and about my work at thedavisreport.wordpress.com or on my YouTube channel, GreenWave 2010 FB, like football.
Thank you very much, MK. That was a very informative segment.
Appreciate it.
We may have lost the very beginning of it, so I'm really glad that you reintroduced yourself at the end. So even if there was a technical problem, people definitely know who you were and where to find you.
Okay, well, thank you.
And we'll talk to you again next month.
All right, thanks a lot.
All right.
Good night.
Good night.
Hello, Chuck.
Hello, Mike. I thought we were about to have the music, but they seem to be running a little late, maybe after our interruption.
there was a glitch in some kind of a glitch when you were calling him. Is that right? There's our music. Hello. Well, here's something. A TV schedule update from your local newspaper insert CIA TV guide. Coming this summer, Across the Pond, a hit British program that is sure to kill in America as well. Oh, God, I've shat myself again. Tells the story of the daily colored terror warnings and how they affect the local families. Sponsored by Left Behind Adult Diapers for the Christian conservative concerned about possibly not being raptured up because of something they might have done or not done. Oh, God, I've shat myself again. Look for it this summer. Also coming in June, the new reality TV show hosted by Bill Hicks, Smart Americans. Not all Americans are effing stupid, really. Part of this program, war is not about flag waving and patriotism. War is about killing and death. Our leaders are cruel because only those willing to be inordinately cruel and remorseless can hold positions of leadership in the foreign policy establishment. People capable of expressing a full human measure of compassion and empathy toward faraway, powerless strangers do not become President of the United States or Vice President or Secretary of State or National Security Advisor or Secretary of the Treasury. From 1945 to 2003, the United States attempted to overthrow more than 40 foreign governments and to crush more than 30 populist nationalist movements fighting against intolerable regimes. In the process, the U.S. bombed some 25 countries, caused the end of life for several million people, and condemned many millions more to a life of agony and despair. You can't believe a word the American media says. If they are saying anything correct, it's just an accident. The new reality TV show hosted by Bill Hicks, Smart Americans. Not all Americans are effing stupid, really. The following are excerpts from a conversation between Lou Rockwell and Russ Baker talking about the Boston bombing.
Baker. In the information that has come out, we're seeing tremendous anomalies, inconsistencies, outright falsehoods, reversals by the agencies, and we are troubled by them. We saw the clampdown on the freedom of movement. We've seen the increasing encroachment of military troops into our American cities. We see the public getting softened up and being made to become more and more comfortable with living in a military state almost. One piece we just did recently is about the shooting of an MIT police officer named Sean Collier. That story was actually a kind of propagandistic moment. And those of us who study and read history remember that back in the Nazi era, there was the killing of a police officer, a Horst Wessel. And they even created a song for the Nazi movement, the Horst Wessel song. Killings of police officers that are magnified like this. And if you go to whowhatwhy.com and read that article, there's a photo of all these baseball players at a stadium standing with their hats off and their heads bent in a giant projection of this one police officer. And what is that for? Why all the focus on this one police officer? And more importantly, what actually happened with this police officer that would make us interested in him?
Rockwell. Well, of course, it's clearly become an unexamined assumption that police are worth more than regular people.
But what interests me here is this particular police officer. And so, first of all, I was struck by the fact that they wanted to make it a big deal about this police officer's death. Biden flew in and addressed his funeral. Now it is logical to ask, why would people attend a funeral of a person they don't know? It's for some reason. And what it really comes down to is it's propagandistic. And what this is focusing the public. And it's very strongly sending out a message that the system is taking care of you and you have to honor the system. This person died for you. And when Officer Collier was killed, we were essentially told either explicitly or implicitly that he'd been killed by these two brothers. Now, that's very interesting. And what's very interesting is at the time that he was killed, all we knew was that these two brothers, whose names were not even public yet, were pictures from a video wearing backpacks, walking along with dozens, hundreds of other people wearing backpacks and walking. And so it was the death of this police officer that set everything into motion. And as soon as I heard about the death of this police officer, I thought, okay, when an officer is down, when that is announced, I can tell you this. They act with a kind of pack mentality, and it suddenly turbocharges. You know, there's a whole tradition, the blue wall of silence and all this. When anything happens to a police officer in any instance, immediately all the other police respond in a very, very aggressive way. And so what you saw was the second he had been shot, boy, whatever the police officers were doing, they were all going to get whoever did this. And so this became the justification for that shootout on the street in Watertown. Later, going after the younger brother, the Sarnia brother, and peppering that boat with gunshots when he wasn't even armed. This was essentially a kind of retribution for their fellow officer, except for one thing. And that is that about a week later, when they were doing this whole big memorial service with Biden and everything, they rather quietly announced that, oh, you know what, actually, the original story that he'd maybe tried to stop these brothers and they'd killed him was not right. It turns out they don't know who shot this man. He didn't confront anybody. And he was assassinated. And you know where he was assassinated, Lou? He was sitting in his patrol car, just sitting there. Somebody came up behind him for no apparent reason and killed him in cold blood. We have no evidence right now that those brothers even did it. But that was the precipitating event that then unleashed all of this firepower. The next thing that happened is this carjacking. An unknown person, whose name is still not public, has said that he was carjacked by these brothers, and they told him, we planted the bomb and we killed that cop. Now, those are two things that there's no hard evidence they did either one of them. But now you've got killed the cop, and then you've got a carjacking with an unnamed person saying, these guys told me they did it. And then one of them is killed. The other one, I believe they attempted to murder him. So what you would have had, Lou, you would have had a situation where both of these suspects would be dead. An unknown witness would connect them to both of the things. The whole thing would be over, and that military, that huge military police response, would have been accepted, and we would be used to the idea that there will be more of these things.
Well, that's right. And of course, then we had the younger brother writing out his confession on the side of the boat in the dark.
Well, in the dark. This guy was basically gravely injured. According to the story, which is a little bit strange, of the man who owned that boat, when he went out to check, he saw blood there. I mean, this guy was already in a pool of blood before they called the cops. Because we know he's gravely injured in the hospital. So the likelihood that he was in any shape, you know, to sort of heroically prop himself up and go to these incredible lengths to scrawl out a confession virtually with his dying breath, it's a little bit hard to believe. At the end, I think the notion was that they thought this guy was going to die. That was the intent, it seems. And another thing we've been reporting is that that confession was reported to us by John Miller, a senior correspondent at CBS News. It's very, very important to remember that John Miller's last major job was that he was a top official of the FBI. He was a lead spokesman for the FBI. He loves the FBI. He's very, very close with them. And this is the man who's now back in journalism and telling us this story. He's also been a key figure throughout. He got one of those so-called exclusive interviews with the unknown carjacking victim. So in other words, this entire narrative is being constructed essentially by the FBI or its allies.
I always think of the FBI as the American secret police. And if you call them that, then when you see this sort of thing going on, it seems to me you ought to take things with maybe not a grain of salt, but a cup of salt. I find the Boston bombing story absolutely rife with weird messaging.
Well, I'll give you an example. the shooting of Officer Collier was almost a dead ringer for the shooting of Officer Tippit in the Lee Harvey Oswald John F. Kennedy saga. Lee Harvey Oswald wouldn't even have been a real suspect in the Kennedy assassination had not a police officer been shot shortly after Kennedy was killed. Because Oswald was just one of many people who worked in that building, he only became really a suspect when this police officer was shot, and then the description of the man who shot him matched Oswald. So here you see a very, very similar thing, where it's a police officer goes down right after this other event and plays a role, essentially, in tying them, making these non-suspects suspects, and making them very, very guilty.
Our next guest of the evening is Anthony Rayson. Anthony speaks to us each month from Chicago. Anthony is a former freeway toll operator. He's also been a publisher for many years. He publishes with his own money publication zines. And what he does is he's in contact with prison writers who are incarcerated. And he corresponds with him, and they send him writings, and he publishes. He gets the word out, and he comes to us. Anthony tells us each month about one or two or three maybe writers, and maybe reads a little bit of it. We're going to get Anthony on the phone right about now. You can also find Anthony Rayson's archives online at DePaul University. If you go to DePaul University online, find
him. Hello.
Hello, Anthony. It's Chuck and Mike and the New American Dream Radio Show, and you're on the air.
Well, good to talk to you. I had planned on reading some letters from prisoners that have actually made something of themselves, a positive story, because it's always so negative. So even in spite of all that, good things can happen. But I've decided to shift gears a little bit and read some material by Kathy Kelly, who has just recently been put back into prison about 4 weeks ago. She is the spearhead of Voices for Creative Nonviolence. She's a real treasure in Chicago. She's just a voice of morality. She's just an Irish Catholic wonder in the South Side. I just love this lady. Anyway, she's in prison now for, of all crimes, trying to deliver a loaf of bread to a commander at the Air Force base to try to persuade him to stop sending lethal drone flights to Afghanistan. So I'll read her piece. It's called My Future in Prison. I will be free in 3 months, but our collective future is mostly assuredly shackled to a wrong-headed criminal justice system. The Bureau of Prisons contacted me today, assigning me a prison number and a new address. For the next 90 days, beginning tomorrow, I'll live at FMC Lexington in the satellite prison camp for women adjacent to Lexington's Federal Medical Center for Men. Very early tomorrow morning, Buddy Bell, Cassandra Dixon, and Paco and Silver, two house guests whom we first met in protest in South Korea's Jeju Island, will travel with me to Kentucky and deliver me to the prison gates. In December 2014, Judge Matt Whitworth sentenced me to 3 months in federal prison after Georgia Walker and I had attempted to deliver a loaf of bread and a letter to the commander of Whiteman Air Force Base, asking him to stop his troops from piloting lethal drone flights over Afghanistan from within the base. Judge Whitworth allowed me over a month to surrender myself to prison, but whether you are a soldier or a civilian, a target or an unlucky bystander, you can't surrender to a drone. When I was imprisoned at Lexington Prison in 1988, after a federal magistrate of Missouri sentenced me to 1 year in prison for planting corn on nuclear missile silo sites, other women prisoners playfully nicknamed me Missiles. One of my sisters reliably made me laugh today, texting me to ask if I thought the women this time, they would call me Drones. It's good to laugh and feel camaraderie before heading into prison. For someone like me, very nearly saturated in white privilege, through much of this arrest, trial, and sentencing process, 90% or more of my experience will likely depend on attitude. But for many of the people I'll meet in prison, An initial arrest very likely began with something like a night raid staged in Iraq or Afghanistan, complete with armed police surrounding and bursting into their home to remove them from children and families, often with helicopters overhead, sequestering them in a county jail, often with very little oversight to assure the guards and wardens treat them fairly. Some prisoners will not have had a chance to see their children before being shipped clear across the country. Some will not have been given adequate medical care if they adjust to life in prison, possibly going without prescribed medicines, and often traumatized by the sudden dissolution of ties with family and community. Some will not have had the means to hire a lawyer and may not have learned much about their case from an overworked public defender. In the U.S., the criminal justice system disproportionately incarcerates people of color for petty offenses. Many take plea bargains under threat of excessive punitive sentences. If I were a young black male, the U.S. penal system quite likely would not have allowed me to turn myself into a federal prison camp. I'll be incarcerated in a satellite camp outside a medical facility where I expect the wards are crowded with geriatric patients. How bleak and unnecessary it is to confine people for decades. My friend Brian Terrell, who was incarcerated in Yankton, South Dakota for 6 months after crossing the line at Whiteman Air Force Base, told me that while in prison, he saw signs on the walls recruiting prisoners to train for medically assisting geriatric male prisoners. I shudder to think of our culture's pervading callousness, pointlessly consigning so many aged people to languish in prison. I will be free in 3 months, but our collective future is most assuredly shackled to a wrong-headed criminal justice system. I hope this compulsively vengeful and diseased criminal justice system will change during my lifetime. And I hope that my short sojourn inside Lexington's prison walls will help me better understand and perhaps help shed some small light on the systems that affect other people trapped there. During recent visits with concerned communities focused on drone warfare, many have helped me see a connection between the drone killings across Central Asia and the Middle East, and the casual executions and incarceration of young black males in our own country. In Afghanistan, where the noise of airstrikes and civil war have faded to the buzz of drones and the silence of empty promises, our friends in the Afghan Peace Volunteers, APVs, continue their peace-building efforts. Last week, 80 street children walked from the APV Center to the Afghan Independent Human Rights Commission office to assert their rights to education. Their signs expressed their determination to help create a school for street children. One sign said, "We don't want your charity, we want dignity." Our young friends wish to provide a better life for the very children whose only other ways off the streets may well include joining the Taliban, criminal gangs, or some other militia. Meanwhile, the United States' vengeful stance as a nation concerned with protecting its wealth and status at all costs and its safety above all considerations of equity or reason, destroys the lives of the impoverished at home as it destroys those abroad. The Black Lives Matter protests need our support, as do the March 6 shutdown protests to shut down Creech Air Force Base. Our friends in the Afghan Peace Volunteers will continue to do vital work for peace and solidarity in Kabul that needs our support. It's encouraging to know that thousands upon thousands of committed people seek and find work to make our world less like a prison for our neighbors and ourselves. My address for the next 3 months is Kathy Kelly, Kathy with a K, 04971-045, FMC Lexington, Federal Medical Center, Satellite Camp, P.O. Box 14525, Lexington, Kentucky, 40512. I just received another article by her a few days ago, in which she tagged, says, "This article is available to ABC for reproduction." So she's interested in having us publish it. She's not afraid of anarchists. She's one of us. She's a humanist. So if you'd like, I could read a little bit of this, too. I know I'm probably running out of time.
Well, there's still probably 4 minutes left. Maybe.
Okay, this piece is called The Shift. we must rapidly begin this shift from a thing-oriented society to a person-oriented society when machines and computers, profit motives, and property rights are considered more important than people. The giant triplets of racism, extreme materialism, and militarism are incapable of being conquered. Martin Luther King in his essay Beyond Vietnam. This is a week ago, so she'd been in prison 3 weeks by then. Here in Lexington Federal Prison Camp, Atwood Hall defies the normal Bureau of Prisons fixation on gleaming floors and spotless surfaces. Creaky, rusty, full of peeling paint, chipped tiles, and leaking plumbing, Atwood just won't pass muster. One of the four federal prisons I've lived in, this particular unit may be the most conducive to mental health. Generally, the Bureau of Prisons system pushes guards to value buffed floors more than the people buffing the floors, walking the floors. Here the atmosphere seems less uptight, albeit tinged with resigned acceptance, but everyone is more or less stuck in what one prisoner described as the armpit of the system. I think every prison throughout the system should be closed, but if it weren't for the asbestos and concerns about toxic water, perhaps this old hall would be better than the more modern facilities prison architects have designed. At any rate, new prisoners arrive each week, indicating the warehouse is open for storing more human beings. I thought of my younger self this morning while gazing out of the third floor window at fields, trees, and farms outside. In 1989, when this prison was a maximum security prison for women, I spent 9 months here after having planted corn on nuclear missile silo sites in Missouri. Confined to first floor environs, other prisoners and I stared at the fields and horses outside prison through chain link fences and coil barbed wire. Even so, we saw a beautiful spring that year in Kentucky. Reliably, spring will again emerge. Slowly, I'm forming relationships now, unusual friendships that will likely grow. I'm also finding extended time to read and study. In the prison library, I found Siddhartha Mukherjee's The Emperor of Maladies, a biography of cancer. When I finished reading it, I felt troubled and deeply moved. Mukherjee, an oncologist and researcher, traces the history of cancer. His narrative includes personal stories about himself and his patients. Through their lives and struggles, he draws readers into scientific discussions of the disease itself, as well as the slow and often disappointing developments of treatment and prevention. He believes he must help his patients resist total despair. Mukherjee notes how concentration camp survivor Primo Levi had often remarked that among the most fatal qualities of the camp was its ability to erase the idea of a life outside and beyond itself. To be in the camps was to abnegate history, identity, and personality, but it was the erasure of the future that was the most chilling. I've heard prison described as hard time. It's a phrase given strange and tragic resonance by the walling off of these women's futures. Shortly before I arrived here, a woman on my floor had removed all her photos from her bulletin board, convinced that she would soon be among a few inmates recently granted immediate release because of retroactive changes in sentencing laws for drug-related charges. "I'm not going to get immediate release," she sadly told me. When she finished recomposing the board, she told me about each photo. Like pieces of a puzzle, the stories helped form her life story, full of human desire to love and be loved. "She'll likely be here for 33 more months, having already been down for 17 months. The cherished photos and memories, the painful fact of their own love of the world outside, helps pull women through hellish feelings of utter isolation and despair." Our society barely recognizes the futility of imprisoning people for onerously long sentences. I think that Mukherjee and wonder whether U.S. people invested as much money in cancer research as they did in Super Bowl celebrations this year. Well, there's more to it, but I'm sure I'm about out of time. But she's a very important voice in these strange times we live in. She's always on site when the U.S. attacks other countries. She's in Baghdad when they're bombing the hell out of it. She's in Kabul. She's holding dying babies in the 90s when the sanctions killed hundreds of thousands of children in Iraq. She's a true human being, and I really respect her life's work.
And now, from Port Orange, Florida, with stops at Information Clearinghouse, Dandelion Salad, Nation of Change, World News Trust, and many others, here is Phil Ferrugio with It's the Empire, Stupid.
Good evening, Working Stiffs. Osama, Obama, Bush, It's the Empire, Stupid. All three of the aforementioned men were creatures of the, and are creatures of the American military-industrial empire. They were nurtured, influenced, subsidized, and controlled by this machine. Bin Laden was one of the many rich, educated Muslims who became brainwashed by what I call the Islam or bust mindset. Much like the Orthodox Zionists who rule Israel and the right-wing zealots here at home who preach their phony Christianity, any such belief system plays directly into the hands of the empire. Go and watch Lorraine Levy's fine film, The Other Son, 2012, came out, and see why this empire so fears harmony amongst different cultural groups. It is better to divide and conquer than to deal with mass movements of people before profits. I await the time that more of my fellow Americans come to the realization that Obama and Bush Jr. were really born of the same dastardly parents, the empire. Regardless of the fact, as William Blum explains in his new book of essays, America's Deadliest Export, Democracy, that Obama is bright and articulate, he still then serves the same interests as his predecessor. Many of my dear friends and one fellow activist who worked so diligently to get this man elected are now slowly having buyer's remorse. During the height of the health care reform, oxymoron, debate a few short years ago, we who knew better told everyone that the so-called public option, a.k.a. Medicare for All, who want it, would never be proposed by Obama and his party. Why? Well, look at the numbers. In the 2008 presidential campaign, McCain received over $7 million in donations from the healthcare industry, including insurance companies. Barack Obama received over $21 million. What is now referred to as Obamacare is a gold ribbon for the private insurers. Bush Jr. kept asking, why do they hate us after the terrible events of 9/11? If one studies this American empire by reading The Untold History of the United States by Kuznick and Stone, or Rogue State by William Blum, one would understand all that was done covertly by a government through the entire planet to see that hatred. After many hours of research on 9/11, did this writer knows inherently that things were not what they seemed? This empire always needs a boogeyman out there in the darkness to both frighten and control us. Bush Jr. and his gang got just that with 9/11 in spades. If you read all the accounts that have come out since then, you would know that they were planning way before September 11, 2001, to invade and occupy Afghanistan and then Iraq. Barack Obama knew that the empire committed an illegal and immoral preemptive attack and occupation of Iraq. Yet, when he became president and the calls came out for hearings and possible indictments for the war criminal Bush and his gang, Obama said it was time to look forward and not back. And he did just that, too. He looked forward and increased by 10 times the use of drone missile attacks in Libya, Yemen, Pakistan, and Afghanistan that killed 10 times more innocent civilians than it did terrorist suspects. All our American empire has done concerning the Middle East is exacerbate the rise of fanatical Islam, not curb it. Look what's happening now with ISIL. Back here at home, our wave the flag mentality seeps into our everyday life. The boob tube is full of tributes to those young pawns in uniform that are sent to places they should never have been sent to. One cannot watch any major sporting event without the customary salutes to our, quote, brave warriors. Tell me this, when was the last time our Congress actually declared war on any of those countries we have attacked or occupy now? Yet the costs go up and up in lives of our own and those we invade and occupy and destroy with our smart bombs and missiles. The cost here at home in not only the mangled bodies of our young soldiers, but in our soon-to-be bankrupt economy. When over half our taxes goes to this empire's overkill and overspend military mindset, our towns and cities are crumbling before our eyes. All the basic services and safety nets are fading away. And it matters not at all whether we elect a Republican or Democrat to those who run this puppet show. Perhaps the millions of license plates that now promote Army, Marines, and Navy should be substituted by the car owners to say, pull back the empire, now. Now that would be patriotic. Thank you.
I'm mad as hell, and I'm not going to take it anymore. Hello, everyone. Now for your local Earth news. This is Chuck Gregory and Mike Polacek with a review of today's news from the eye of the hurricane and the eye of the blizzard. And now, a New American Dream radio show guest editorial comment by New American Dream Back to the Future reporter Mario Savio, substituting for New American Dream bowling reporter Jeffrey Lebowski, who had a lead game tonight.
For 200 years, Americans have been indoctrinated with a mythology created, imposed, and sustained by a manipulating cabal, the financial elite that built its absolute control on the muscle and blood, goodwill, ignorance, and credulity of its citizenry. America began with the invasion of a populated continent and the genocide of its native people. Once solidly established, it grafted enslavement of another race onto that base. Once the existing oligarchy was secure in law and native people largely exterminated, the ruling class increased its wealth and power fantastically in the 19th century, using the government as its enabler, exploiting to the limit the device of chartered corporations. With its phenomenal money power, the financial elite began to use the military to expand its sway beyond the continent. Regions, territories, islands, and whole countries were annexed, invaded, and possessed outright, their peoples crushed, suppressed, and ruled. Because ordinary Americans, like any people, need to believe that whatever the ruling elite undertakes in their nation's name must be essentially benevolent, noble in purpose, and justified in fact. The myth had to be radically modified for imperial expansion. The foundational story was that Americans had come to a howling wilderness teeming with godless savages and through invincible strength of character and purity of purpose had tamed the land and honorably earned the right to possess their bountiful home. In the era of extraterritorial expansion, that version was polished to justify and ennoble imperialism. On radio and television, Americans were subjected to an unrelenting barrage of hyperpatriotism in which American moral superiority was a given and America's self-touted courage, generosity, and decency were its unchallengeable proofs. The implosion of the Soviet Union left America, in its own terminology, the sole superpower in a unipolar world. This, however, did not result in diminution of the myth. The practical effect of having no doomsday enemy was to supercharge it by increasing its element of pure hubristic ego. Power corrupts, said Lord Mahan, and absolute power corrupts absolutely. When the only rival and counterweight to American power disintegrated, there was a sense within the American power elite that the opportunity existed for the first time in history for one country to absolutely dominate and effectively control the entire world. This consensus was expressed in a policy statement composed by a cadre of major right-wing political players representing massive corporate capitalist interests, called the Project for a New American Century. This triumphalist manifesto laid out a plan for absolute American access and control of essential resources and raw materials worldwide, to be guaranteed by the military, which would enforce full spectrum dominance. The attack on the towers, an unimaginable provocation, was the trigger mechanism for the explosive launch of the effort to impose that imperial model in practice on the world. It has been, without question, the most spectacular failure in the history of American misadventure. An impartial observer would have to say that the hypnotic hold of the American myth on the loyalty of the people has led only to disgrace and disaster, and set a direct course to inevitable imperial decline and ruin. The tragic reality is that for the majority, their own identities have been so deeply and thoroughly infused with the myth that to disbelieve it is to disbelieve in themselves. It is the millions of us with no work and no hope in middle age whose jobs and homes have been devoured by the heartless fraud machine of Wall Street. It's the trashed and demolished weed lots of our major cities, eroding in crumbling, fire-gutted ruin. It is the many towns and cities with industries shut down and factories deserted or dismantled and shipped overseas. It is our decaying, disintegrating public schools, our bankrupt states and counties, our overtaxed, antiquated public transportation systems, our obsolete, dissolving infrastructure, our bloated, irrational prison complex, our punishing and inadequate health care disaster, and over it all, the repressive mechanism of our police state, armed and empowered, ready for use against the American people themselves. It is up to us who know and care to lead. As Thomas Paine said, these are the times that try men's souls. Nothing is guaranteed us. That can't matter. We cannot be concerned with odds or outcomes. We cannot let the machine of injustice grind on. We must oppose it with all the moral force we own. We must act with quiet courage to confront a vicious, tyrannical system that is destroying the earth, its life, and its people. We must put our lives on the line to oppose it. The nightmare machine of rapacious exploitation has overthrown humanity's decency and reason, and its bloody inhuman treason flourishes over us. This must be ended. Let your life be a friction now to stop the machine.
A New American Dream radio show guest editorial comment by New American Dream Back to the Future reporter Mario Savio, substituting for New American Dream bowling reporter Jeffrey Lebowski, as he had a league game tonight. That's all, folks. That's news, and we are out of here. Good night and good luck, and so it goes. Stay classy, San Diego. That's the way it is. Stay on the same page. Take it to the next level. At the end of the day, it is what it is. Have a good day. Bring something to the table, and always remember to tip your congressman. Our next guest of the evening is Larry Pinkney. Larry Pinkney speaks to us each month from Minneapolis. Larry is a radio show host, a writer, an activist. He's a former member of the National Black Panther Party. And Chuck will get Larry on the line right now.
Hello.
Well, hello, Larry. I'm sorry we're running a little bit late tonight, so you're going to have a little less time than usual.
Okay.
This is Chuck and Mike and the show, and you're on the air.
Great. Well, thanks for calling and tell me when I should start.
Start right away.
Okay. Well, first of all, thanks for making the contact. It's always a pleasure to be on the show. I'll speak very quickly. I want to talk about something that I think affects all of us, and that's the economic austerity, I call it blood-sucking, that all of us in this country, black, white, brown, red, and yellow, are having to endure. And, you know, I think most of us, or many of us, have heard about what is going on in the nation of Greece, but perhaps some of us have not linked that to what is going on right here in the United States. And by economic austerity, I mean corporate hegemony, corporate domination, corporate takeover. I'm talking specifically about the fact that the people, everyday, ordinary, black, white, brown, red, and yellow people in this nation do not own or control our governments. And it's high time that we do that. Corporations own and control our governments, be they whatever political party or plantation, as I call them, people may want to think of themselves affiliated with, be it Democrat, Republican. It's really Republicrat because they feed from the same trough. I want to link what I'm saying to a struggle that I believe I may have mentioned on a previous program, but I think it's very important that all of us understand a struggle in Benton Harbor, Michigan. Benton Harbor is a small township which is under the control of a so-called emergency manager, which is really nothing but a genteel name, for a dictator, a so-called emergency manager, where the elected officials, the people, have no control, no authority whatsoever. And of course, I think all of us know about Detroit, Michigan, as well as other parts of Michigan, where exactly the same thing is taking place. There is a struggle going on in Benton Harbor. This struggle has been led in large portion by a man by the name of Reverend Edward Pinckney. Yes, it's the same last name as mine, but we are not related. We're not related biologically. All of us are brothers and sisters, black, white, brown, red, and yellow, all of us in the struggle. But Reverend Edward Pinckney, as I may or may not have mentioned, was imprisoned on December 15th at the behest, really, of Whirlpool Corporation. That's right, Whirlpool. The people who make washing machines, et cetera, actually very few things are made in this country anymore. Whirlpool has outsourced work jobs, et cetera, to other countries, which also is a part of what I refer to as the economic blood-sucking or, in essence, austerity. That's really what austerity is all about, pitting people against each other, fighting for crumbs, when in fact, it's the people who should own and control the entire pie, much less the crumb. So I want everybody to keep this in mind and to support, to think, not only think of supporting, but support Reverend Edward Pinckney, because he is engaged in a decade-long struggle. You can just Google his name, Reverend Edward Pinckney. You'll see all kinds of information about what has been done to him, how he's been in prison. And I want you to keep in mind that who's really behind it, the hidden hand, is the corporation, Whirlpool, or the corporation of Whirlpool. This is what's really happening to all of us, no matter where we are in any part of this country. We've got to unite. We have got to unite. So it's not just about Greece and what's happening there. I'm glad to see the people standing up to the bloodsuckers who have sucked their country dry. But it's happening to us. It's just happening perhaps a little slower than people imagine. Or actually, it's happening much faster than people imagine, but slower in terms of people waking up to see what is going on. So I urge everyone, all of us, to stand up, come together, check out what's going on, go online, check out what the struggle is that's taking place in Benton Harbor, and remember that struggle is taking place all over this nation and really throughout the world. But many of us, quote-unquote, Americans don't see it, but we better wake up, we better organize, and the late, great Joe Hill said, don't mourn, organize. In other words, let's do something about it. And as Malcolm X said, you know, sad people don't do anything. Mad people, that is to say, people who are just not going to tolerate it anymore, why, we're the ones who get things done. So let's remember this struggle. Let's be a part of it. Let's be a part of the struggle in Benton Harbor and in Detroit. Let's be a part of the struggle that Reverend Edward Pinckney and the people of Detroit and Benton Harbor, Michigan are engaged in. Let's pull together on this. Our very lives, our livelihoods are at stake. So I just wanted to emphasize that. I don't have much time, obviously, so I'm not going to take up any more of the time. I want to thank you, brothers, for this program, this show. It's absolutely essential. We've got to pull together. Remember, each one reach one. Each one teach one. All right? And as we said back in the day in the original Black Panther Party, all power to the people, black, white, brown, red, and yellow. That's it. I'm not going to take any more time. And thank you so much for this opportunity.
Well, thanks again, Larry. And could you remind the listeners where they can find you on the web?
Oh, yes. You can go. Thank you so much. You can go to blackactivistwg.org. Again, blackactivistwg.org. The WG stands for Writers Guild. And once you go on that, you'll find you'll be connected to the home page. But then look at the right side of the home page. Scroll down to where it says Larry Pinckney Archives. Okay, on the right side of the home page, click on that, and you'll find that from the years 1968 to the present, 2015, you will find articles, activities, the struggle, what I have been doing, what I write about, as well as linking to other sisters and brothers of all colors. So I hope you'll enjoy it. I hope you will do that. Again, blackactivistwg.org. Check it out for yourself. Thank you so much. Stay strong.
And now a message in a Boone's Farm bottle, some notes we have been receiving during the first half of our show from listeners by email, chat room, telephone, telepathy, and telegraph. We hear by telepathy from Mahatma Mohandas Dude Lebowski in Los Angeles. He says, the human voice can never reach the distance that is covered by the still small voice of conscience. And from a Walter Sobchak, also in L.A., a normal person does not want to kill and will avoid it at all costs. The military won't let you remain normal. It doesn't matter if you think you are smart enough not to get caught up in their lies. They will change you. Don't be sucked into the biggest myth and lie that dying for your country is somehow heroic. From Ben in Virginia City, I cannot in good conscience thank any military man for his service. I haven't been able to salute the flag nor sing the Star Spangled Banner for decades. I now no longer vote. How any servicemen could have targeted farmers and children in World War II, Korea, or Vietnam, now Iraq and Afghanistan, well, shame be upon his soul. Our generals like the genocidal Eisenhower and presidents are monsters, and a flamethrower upon them should have been their punishment. I take solace in the thought that he and Roosevelt, Churchill, and the rest are burning in hell for all eternity. From Archie in Queens, it's beyond sick what the big three mobsters, Stalin, Churchill, and Rosenfeld, or whatever his real name was, did to Germany. They were all from the same ethnic mafia, and I'll let you figure out which tribe they belonged to. Dresden was a vanity mass murder for the chosen mob. The war was already lost. But hey, what could be more fun than the Morgenthau plan of complete German annihilation just for the fun of it? And now from Russ in New York City. Another story going up probably today is how the New York Times, instead of investigating any of these things, they quickly have somebody roll out a story talking about conspiracy theorists and how anybody who has questions about things basically is sort of mentally ill, which is a very, very important contradiction. If you ask any questions and you don't accept the conventional narrative that everything is just fine, there is something really, really wrong with you. Now, you were talking about the KGB and putting people into mental hospitals, but you know, that happens in the U.S. all the time. And just one example is there was an Army sergeant by the name of Dinkin, who was intercepting cables and big top secret stuff at a military base in 63, and he divined from his own monitoring of cable traffic that there was an assassination plot against JFK, and he divined that the assassination plot was going to involve right-wingers and members of the military and some foreign assassins, and it was going to take place in Dallas in November of 1963. And when he tried to say what he knew, they put him into a mental hospital, and they began injections, and they began essentially doing mind control things with him. And eventually he was forced to say, oh, no, the reason I said those things, and he gave some other explanation that was totally benign. And that was the only way that this man could basically get out of the gulag. So if you think that these things only go on in the Soviet Union, you're wrong.
We also have a note from Arthur Digby Sellers in North Hollywood near the In-N-Out Burger. Washington's 14 years of war on terror has cost Americans a minimum of $6 trillion. That's $6,000 billion. Without the vast sum wasted on the war on terror, Republicans would not have an excuse to be trying to cut Social Security and Medicare for budget reasons. Combating terrorism is the excuse for squandering a minimum of $6,000 billion. What were the terrorist events that served as a basis for this expenditure? There are five. 9/11, the London Transport System bombings, the Spanish train bombing, the Boston Marathon bombing, and the French Charlie Hebdo rifle attack. In other words, five events in 14 years. The loss of life and all these events combined is minuscule compared to the loss of life in the war on terror. Even the number of deaths of our own soldiers is greater. Washington's wars against terror have caused more deaths of Americans than the alleged terrorist events themselves. But were they terrorist events? There are many reasons to suspect these terrorist attacks. Governments have always resorted to false flag events in order to serve secret agendas. The Tsar's secret police set off bombs in order to create grounds for arresting labor agitators. We know from Operation Gladio that Western intelligence services did the same thing in order to blame European communist parties and block their electoral gains. The 9/11 Truth Movement, consisting of 2,300 architects and engineers, physicists, nanochemists, military and airline pilots, first responders, and former government officials, has blown the official 9/11 story out of the water. No one with a brain believes the official story. There are peculiarities and contradictory evidence with regard to the London transport bombing and the Spanish train bombing. Moreover, these bombings arrived at the right time to serve Washington's propaganda and purposes. While what terrorists had to gain from them is unclear and ambiguous, the Boston Marathon bombing and the Paris Charlie Hebdo attack have many characteristics of false flag attacks, but the media have not asked a single question. Instead, the media hypes the official explanations. When questions cannot be asked or answered, it is a reasonable suspicion that something is wrong with the story. The Charlie Hebdo and Boston bombing have in common that the police decided to kill the alleged perpetrators rather than capture them. Just as a person alleged to be Osama bin Laden was gratuitously murdered in the raid on the Mastermind's compound in Pakistan. Dead men tell no tales. They can't contradict the story. The obvious question is, like the question about Osama bin Laden's alleged murder by a SEAL in Abbottabad, Pakistan, why were such valuable intelligence resources killed rather than captured? But the Western print and TV media have not made a point of this obvious question. In the Charlie Hebdo affair, the evidence connecting the brothers to the attack is the claim they left their ID in the getaway car. This reminds me of the passport initially said to have been found in the rubble of the Twin Towers that was used to establish the identity of the alleged perpetrators of 9/11. We're only 2 months short of 2 years since the Marathon bombing, and the surviving brother Zakhar Tsarnaev has still not been brought to trial, nor has he or his attorney been heard from. According to the official story, Zakhar wrote his confession on the side of a boat in which the severely wounded, unarmed 19-year-old was hiding from execution. That such an unlikely story could become part of American reality demonstrates the stupidity of both the authorities and the American public. It's entirely possible that Zakhar's attorney has learned from the Lynn Stewart case that any lawyer who defends his Muslim client will be himself sentenced to federal prison for not cooperating with the government's agenda. But these are speculations. What facts do we have? Well, none, of course, from Washington. Washington needs no facts. Washington is the imperial power. Washington's word rules. The facts be damned. The print and TV media did not dare to contradict Washington on any important point or raise any embarrassing questions. Concerning facts, we have the non-investigated report that a high-ranked French police official, for reasons unknown, killed himself in police headquarters while writing a report on the Charlie Hebdo affair based on this investigation. Police officials spend their lives hoping for a major big-time case, participation in which makes their career memorable. No police official benefiting from such an opportunity would deny himself of it by committing suicide. Did the investigation not support the official story? Was the police official Helric Fredou not compliant with cover-up orders? The media has not asked these questions, and I've seen no reports about the content of Fredou's report. What does his report, finished or unfinished, say? Why isn't this of media interest?
A message to the Boone's Farm Bottle, some notes that I've been receiving during the first half of our show from listeners by email, chat room, telephone, telepathy, and telegraph. Well, it's been another long week in Duluth, Minnesota, my hometown, at the end of the empire. Duluth is big burritos and apricot wheat beer and a parade to celebrate cold weather. Duluth can be murder. It's the big lake, big woods, big tradition, big old buildings. Like an old sailor headed back to his boat at 4 a.m, stumbling, never falling. It's the sauna and the secrets of the North Woods. It's schools on top of bars, on top of bait shops. And it's adventure, and it's being able to be yourself. But Duluth can be murder. It's the trains, the taconite, guns, tattoos, bowling, brawls, Bigfoot, and ball games. It's laser tag. It's the bomb. It's the gold. We continue our story. We met Billy sitting on the hillside overlooking the big lake, having escaped the group home. He's still sitting by himself, thinking his own thoughts.
With puffed cheeks, Billy watched the traffic. He smelled exhaust, even way up here. Or maybe it was that factory over there. Or the wind must have shifted because he couldn't smell the ship or restaurant no more. He looked at the sun just sitting there, tried to tell the time by it. Some olden day guys could do that. Would they miss him? Of course they were already searching everywhere, in his room, TV room, bathroom, the other kids' rooms, up the trees, out on the porch. And they would call the police, and he'd go to the detention center for attempted getting the F away from here. Billy sat up. He pulled his knees up and wrapped his arms around his legs to pin them there. He'd let them think he was interested in all this freezing cold winter crap, but what he really wanted was the gold. Everybody wants money. What else is there? Rich people want more, poor people want some, and when they get that, then they want more. No, he wanted it all. He wanted all their damn money. Now, hand it over nice and easy. Nobody gets hurt. Somebody always gets hurt. There were mines up there. He'd read the... when he was... He'd read that. When he was supposed to be coloring candy canes or somewhere, he planned it all out. There were mines, and that's where you get gold. It's either spread all over in the streets or in the water or the backyard rocks or banks. Some crap. He'd find it. If he had to, he would take it. It was his anyway. That's what Jesus said in church. He'd been to lots of churches. People he stayed with were friends with Jesus and other people, and Jesus said the money belonged to the poor. Well, who was more pissed poor than Billy? He wanted money. He'd buy a house and a car and food and all the t-shirts in the t-shirt store at the big mall. And warm coat nobody ever wore before, and thick socks and boots and gloves. And he'd sit outside all winter long, and he wouldn't even be cold. He'd show them. What they'd do is take the gold from the mines and railroad cars and dump them in the big ships, and then the ships take the gold to the banks, and nobody ever sees it again. Not unless some brave kid, some courageous kid, some kid who somehow miraculously escaped. All the bullcrap they tell you. Not unless that tough little kid who doesn't take crap from nobody does something about it. They'd never seen nothing like him. Now they were gonna. Now. Here. They'll find out what it's all about. He'd find the gold and take it and kill everyone he needs killing and save everybody else. Billy touched the knife, ran a finger up the blade and pulled on the handle. Ran a finger down the blade, looked at his finger, placed the tip on his arm and pressed down. He pushed in harder and pulled back. Red testicle popped up at the tip of the knife. He was no good. He should die. If nobody was strong enough to do it, he'd do it. Moment of decision. Live or die. What took more courage? Pull the knife back. Or stop. Tell me something good. Billy ducked. Tell me that you like it. Yeah, yeah. Hey, shout, summertime blues. Jump up and down in the blue suede shoes. The F is that, Billy hissed to himself. Billy spread his arms and legs and pushed himself into the rock. The singing kept coming, louder, headed his way. Tell me, rock on, like it was directed at him. Jimmy Dean, James Dean. Who the? Billy thought in silence, conserving his breath, using them sparingly like shiny bullets. Billy felt exposed on the big rock. He turned his head and pressed in to make it flat. He pushed his legs and stomach and turned his feet sideways so he could not be seen. He turned on all his invisible powers and, with his mind, pulled his cape all around him, over his head, his feet, and it hit him. The singing had turned to talking, muttering, feet swishing, pushing through grass. It was the group home staff boys and the police and the army. Billy's stomach growled, and the muttering and swishing stopped. He was being surveyed, measured, veiled, surveilled. The army man was right now looking through a periscope and aiming right at Billy's head. Billy could run now and dive into the grass or crawl and stay here and have his head exploded. The acapella swishing started up again, slower. Billy gritted his damn teeth and scraped his head on the rock to look up ahead into the grass and above the grass. A semi-truck yelled its horn at some stupid driver. The ship blew its horn louder than the truck. a fire truck took off from out of the station somewhere close, and its horn hollered louder than the ship or boat. That was how they sneak up on you, using ambient sounds to get in close. Billy looked up and crept his hand down to his blade. He shouldn't look. It would go away. That's how it works. If you look, it will be right there in the window. In the window above the door. The back door. He peeked. The face was right there. Like the horror movie and the killer's right there with you in the house. The face was so big. So bad. So ugly. It couldn't be real. So this was not happening. It was right there in the grass. This was just a head. A head that lived in the grass. There was black curly hair and big black eyebrows that ran in one fat line over the eyes. And the eyes were way back in. And there was a ridge like in the National Geographic drawings of how man had gone from being a lizard to a caveman to real men. Lips were thick for a white guy. And the nose was big and smooshed wide. The eyes were as wide as Billy's were when he saw the lizard crawl into his shoe. And the mouth was open and the head just sat there in the grass. It wasn't real. The big blue eyes blinked. Billy cried out and jumped up and crawled back up to the middle of the rock with his hands and his legs and his cape to fly backward to the middle of the rock. Hey! He cried. Billy jumped up, spread his feet, put up his fists. They'll see you, growled the head. The head sat right there in the middle of the grass and showed its body and feet, arms, everything. Billy was exposed to sniper fire from every direction, and knives and people on the highway could see him, and from behind, the road, the boat. He crouched down and then felt a burn in his thigh and put one knee down into the hard, sharp rock. Better. The headman sat down and crossed his legs. He put up one hand and nodded. Hello, said Billy. Slow, deep, slow, to show he was so bad, so bad. The rock. Billy looked around him at the rock, like a huge wrestling mat. The big rock, the short, stocky man repeated. That's what I call it. Billy looked hard at him. The head guy was older, not like a grandpa, but maybe like a dad. I'm Venom. Put up his hand again. Billy raised a hand this time, as far as his knee. He rehearsed his next line in his head. He might not get to say much more if he was found to be weak. Billy the Kid. Billy the Kid. Billy the Kid. Billy the Kid. He was going to die, strangled, shot, stabbed. Blood on a rock, and then the stupid snow covers it, and a bunch of kids see it later and think it's spray paint, and some dude paints Larry Loves Blowjobs all over the rock in his blood. They stared at each other under the noise of the highway, the shoosh and the hmm and the rrrr. I'm Billy the Damn Kid, Billy said, in a forced gravel growl. Pebbles, last bit of rock dribbling out the chute when your dad's pouring cement for somebody else's driveway. I got a towel like that, Venom said. It's not a... Billy began, but then touched a knot on his throat and felt like a little kid who fell into the kid's book in the daycare foster home quiet room, talking to one of the book characters. They looked at each other without speaking. Without words, they fell into a game of seeing who could go the longest without blinking. Billy lost and blinked about 100 times in a row to get the air back in his eyes. They're sad, Venom said. Who? Billy the Kid let his voice go back to normal. Higher than the bass growl, since Mr. Benham wasn't going to kill him yet. Tires. The tires. He twisted and looked down the hill over the grass and bushes to the highway. They're moaning. Screaming. Hear that? Billy Ames is listening down the hill. I don't know, he said. Putting annoyance and playground gravel in his throat. Venom put up his hands, raised his voice, and opened his eyes wide, then twisted and pointed down the hill. Don't you hear that? Dead people! Here, see, they talk to me! He turned back toward Billy and growled, I can't stand it! He stared right up at Billy in the middle of the big rock. He stared right up at Billy in the middle of the big rock.
And that's the news from Duluth, where all the police and soldiers are thugs, all the Democrats and journalists are cowards, and all the Homeland Security, COINTELPRO, lone gunmen are about average.
And that's just about it for another episode of the New American Dream Radio Show. We appreciate your being with us tonight, and we hope you'll be back every Thursday right here, the New American Dream Radio Show, on Revolution Radio at freedomflips.com. Thank you, Mike, and good night.
Good night, Chuck. Thanks to our guests, Phil Ferruccio, Larry Pinkney, Anthony Race, and M.K. Davis. To get the archives of the show from February 2011, go to theshow.newamericandream.info. And as always, we wish to acknowledge the work of South Dakota stone artist Borglum Borglumson as he works to make over Mount Rushmore, put the real face of American history up there in stone. Lee Harvey Oswald, Sirhan Sirhan, Mark David Chapman, and James Earl Ray. Follow the ongoing project at looserock.com, rollingstones.com, and jackrubyrich.com. To help support the show, please purchase one of our Tom Jefferson Rolling in His Grave Handy Campfire rotisseries for the hobo in your family, or get one of our family-sized Obamaville Tom Jefferson rotisseries for the busy family on the move from town to town, woods to woods, made in Korea. And as always, we apologize for our mistakes and plan to make fewer mistakes next week. To contact the show, either Chuck or me or any of our guests, write to me at nwestiowa@gmail.com. And good night to my friends Chuck and Lorraine. Stay warm down there. And so good night, Mrs. Kalbash. Good night, Todd Beamer. Good night, Mark Bingham. Good night, Daniel Lewin. Good night, Ken Lay. Good night, Timothy McVeigh. Good night, Emily Parker. Good night, Ben Wheeler. Good night, Crystal Campbell. Good night, Nancy Lanza. Good night, James Foley and Stephen Sotloff. Good night, Charlie Hebdo. And good night, Barbara Olson, wherever you are.